The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. Beginning today with the Huffington Post. Backwards beach days could be a game changer for your summer vacation. By Kelsey Borison. Going to the beach with little kids often isn't all that relaxing for parents. But this one change to your approach can make it far more enjoyable for parents and kiddos alike. Kelsey Pomeroy is a content creator in Kansas City, Missouri, and a mother of two who has started doing backwards beach days when she vacations with her 4-year-old and 1-year-old. The basic premise is this. Instead of hitting the beach in the morning, like most families do, they wait until the late afternoon, after her kids have woken up from their naps. She now considers herself a PM beach person. This realization has actually made me like going to the beach with small children, Pomeroy said in an Instagram reel, explaining the concept that has racked up almost 2 million views since she posted it in February. Growing up, Pomeroy told HuffPost that her family's beach days would go like this. Eat breakfast, head to the beach for the day, come home before dinner to shower, and get ready to go out to a restaurant. But after becoming a parent herself, she discovered that that is the literal opposite schedule that works for little kids. Pomeroy decided to switch things up so she could actually enjoy the beach with her sons. In the mornings, they now do quicker and easier activities, like the pool or the park, followed by an early lunch at a restaurant. Then they put their kids down for their naps. After they wake up, they head to the beach around 3 or 4 p.m. for a few hours. Dinner is a sunset picnic on the beach. She swears by this schedule for a few reasons. For one, restaurants are less crowded and less expensive at lunchtime, and young children tend to do better eating out earlier in the day. I will do anything to avoid 6 p.m. dinner with tired kids, said Pomeroy. The beach is also less packed in the late afternoon and early evening, when a lot of folks have gone home for the day. Plus, the UV index is lower at this time, and you don't need to bother setting up an umbrella. If your toddler struggles with transitions, there's yet another upside of a PM beach trip. For little kids who have a hard time ending an activity, they can visibly see the sun going down, like, "It's bedtime," Pomeroy said. That's a very easy way to walk away. It's also a fun but low-stimulation activity to tire kids out and helps them wind down for the night, she added. We just leave the beach, get them washed up, and put them straight to bed, and they're already fed, she said. John Marshall is the father of 4 kids between the ages of 2 and 14. He called the backwards beach day concept marvelous. Having a wife that is very sun conscious, we try to limit sun exposure, and the backwards beach days concept simplifies it without losing any part of the beach experience, he said. Also, it allows family to engage in sites that are normally not so crowded during summer days, such as aquariums and museums, since everyone is at the beach. Having a family of six, we prioritize minimizing commotion, and being out at a beach full of other people is not how we visualize a good time. The backwards beach day was conceived with parents of young kids in mind, but it's a great idea for anyone who wants to stay out of the sun, avoid overstimulation and large crowds, and save money, too. That said, a backwards beach day may not be right for every family or every beach location. For example, if you plan to go in the water with your kids, then you should do so when there's a lifeguard on duty, if that's an option at your beach, or during times of better visibility. Pomeroy's kids generally play in the sand and on the edges of the water, but they don't go in the ocean, so it isn't an issue for them. For kids who are old enough to question why you're doing things differently than other families, Marshall said he'd share the reasons and use it as a teachable moment. Let them know not all drummers' beats are the same, and you and they are creating your family tradition and culture. From the New York Times, Menopause Should Not Be Such a Mystery, by Melinda French Gates, a philanthropist, businesswoman, and global advocate for women and girls. Early in the 20th century, childbirth in America looked very different than what you'll find in most labor and delivery wards today. Many hospital births involved twilight sleep, a cocktail of drugs that rendered a woman unconscious for delivery. If she started thrashing, as women often did, she could be tied to the bed. She had no loved ones in the room to advocate for her, and no voice in the process. Just drugs, disorientation, and in the end, a baby she had no memory of delivering. Most of us look back on that era with a shudder. It's hard to imagine how we ever came to accept a practice like that as standard. I sometimes wonder if my granddaughters will have a similar reaction when they look back on the way our healthcare system approaches menopause care today. Like the women who were knocked out for their deliveries, women going through menopause have an alarmingly high chance of experiencing care that fails them completely. Here's a scene that regularly plays out across the country. A woman walks into her doctor's office with an increasingly debilitating set of symptoms. Her sleep destroyed, joints aching, heart racing, memory slipping, and walks out with no diagnosis, no treatment, and no plan. Maybe you know her. Maybe you've been there. Nearly one in three U.S. women over 40 experience severe menopause symptoms, and those symptoms can be severe enough to disrupt daily life. For many women, menopause means waves of depression they've never experienced before, or terrible insomnia. The underlying hormonal changes driving these symptoms increase a woman's risk of cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis, and certain types of cancer. Often, these symptoms strike when a woman is at the peak of her career, raising children, and caring for aging parents. There's a whole constellation of people relying on her. The Mayo Clinic estimates that menopause-related symptoms cost the United States $26 billion in medical expenses and lost work time every year. Even so, only about 1 in 4 women in menopause in the United States is treated for her symptoms. Too many women are left to face another sleepless night, their joints still aching, hearts still racing, memories still slipping, while their appeals to the medical system have gotten them nowhere. When I first noticed signs I was starting menopause, it fell to me to raise the topic with my doctor and push for options to manage my symptoms. Even though I have access to excellent health care and have spent the past 25 years as a woman's health advocate, there was a lot I simply didn't know. Some symptoms I learned can have lasting consequences if left untreated. Insomnia can increase the risk of losing cognitive function or developing type 2 diabetes. And hormonal shifts can lead to heart disease. It's no exaggeration to say that the care a woman receives in this moment can change the trajectory of her life. I feel lucky to be living through an era when women are speaking out about what our mother's generation navigated in silence. But solidarity is no substitute for systemic change. That's why I'm expanding my work in women's health to include significant new funding for midlife and menopause care. These investments will bring my total funding for women's health over the past 2 years to more than $600 million. At a time when women's rights are under attack, and too many women are dying during pregnancy and childbirth, I remain deeply committed to my long-standing work in reproductive and maternal health. The funding I announced last week includes additional support for these issues too. We need to fight for women's health on multiple fronts at once. Our society's approach to menopause and perimenopause reflects the deep flaws of a health system that has long treated women as an afterthought. Consider the staggering fact that, according to one survey, less than a third of American OBGYN residency programs offer a menopause curriculum of any kind. That's right. The very doctors who specialize in our bodies aren't always equipped to support us through a biological event we will all encounter. Beyond the training gap, there are gaps in treatment and knowledge. The share of postmenopausal women in the United States using hormone therapy, the most effective solution for managing menopause symptoms we have right now has plummeted to less than 5%. While we know that menopause has implications for bone health, heart health, and brain health, what we don't know is how to protect women from these risks. We need a menopause revolution in this country. Better training is an obvious place to start. By including menopause care in both foundational and continuing education for healthcare practitioners, we can equip more of them to support their patients. Medical schools and residencies need to embed menopause care in their curriculums, and accreditation bodies and licensing boards need to make it a required part of training, not just for OBGYNs, but for anyone who treats women in midlife. We also need action from policymakers, particularly at the state level. Advocates should press lawmakers to create new education requirements, expand insurance and Medicaid coverage for menopause treatments, and ensure that women in menopause have workplace protections the way they do in pregnancy, like the ability to take time off to seek care, so they can keep doing their jobs without sacrificing their health. Public education campaigns can play an essential role in starting new conversations about menopause and addressing the structural barriers that are leading to disparities in who gets care. In the United States, postmenopausal white women are more than twice as likely as Black and Hispanic women to use hormone therapy treatment. Finally, we need additional research to learn more about the range of hormonal and other changes that happen with menopause and their implications for women's well-being, and to accelerate new breakthroughs and treatments. For every dollar the world spends on medical research and development, just 5 cents goes to women's health. We need to change our assumptions about whose bodies are worth understanding. We are seeing the glimmers of real progress. Healthcare practitioners have received updated guidance about hormone therapy, which could reverse years of confusion about when it can be used safely. More companies are offering menopause benefits, and more states are introducing legislation to mandate workplace protections or insurance coverage. For all this, we should thank the women who have been speaking out about their experiences and demanding better. Just as a previous generation took on twilight births, they have set something in motion that is going to touch millions of lives. From USA Today. She helped America win World War II. Meet a real-life Rosie the Riveter. By Phaedra Trethen. Jennifer McMullen had two brothers fighting during World War II, one in the European theater and the other in the South Pacific. And so the Ohio native turned Phoenix transplant was happy when she landed a job as a riveter at a California Lockheed factory. "I worked the night shift," she told USA Today via video call from her home in Whittier, California. her son Tim by her side. I was 18, and I lived on my own, and I felt like I was contributing to getting my brothers home. Her brothers did come home safely, thankfully, and McMullen, now 101 years old, will celebrate her 80th wedding anniversary with her husband, Mel, at the National World War II Museum, as the New Orleans site hosts 31 real-life Rosie the Riveters at its 2026 American Spirit Awards. June 6th was the 82nd anniversary of D-Day, when Allied troops invaded Normandy, France, turning the tide of the war in Europe. Rosie the Riveter started from a song, the Library of Congress says on its website. At 19, Rosalind Walker worked as a riveter at an aircraft manufacturer in Connecticut. And two songwriters, inspired by a newspaper account of her work, penned a song called Rosie the Riveter. The song and the idea quickly caught on, and Rosie became a symbol for women who'd gone to factories and manufacturing facilities to help with the war effort. Famed artist Norman Rockwell's Saturday Evening Post cover image of a woman in dungarees holding a sandwich and wearing goggles, a riveting gun resting on her lap, and J. Howard Miller's image of a woman flexing her arm with the slogan, "We can do it," helped solidify the idea of a strong, capable, and hard-working woman. McMullen is one of the many women whose wartime work helped the Allied effort as they took on the home front work, not just with their homes and families, but also in the factories and offices that kept the country running and changed the role of women in the workforce. They had to prove themselves. A common misconception is that women stepped seamlessly into factory work while all the men went away to war, says Kim Guise, senior curator and director for curatorial affairs at the World War II Museum. Women were filling jobs left by men who were in the military, but there were still men working alongside them, Guise said. Women were stepping into the workforce, many for the first time, and they were learning new skills, learning trades, and the men they worked with were sometimes okay with working alongside women. But sometimes the men were not okay with women doing what until then had been viewed as men's work, she added. Women had to prove themselves. They were not immediately always welcomed with open arms, even as they were fulfilling an essential role. Women did prove themselves as welders and riveters, assembly line workers, and in myriad other jobs. And there was a lot of pride in that, and that was something I heard over and over again from the women I talked with. They are still very proud of what they did, what they learned, and all of their contributions to the war effort. Working under a camouflage tarp. Jennifer Conaway was born on her grandfather's Ohio farm in 1924, into a family that traced its American roots back to the 1600s. She recalled moving frequently as a child and her family's scrimping and scraping by during the Great Depression. She worked as a legal secretary after graduating high school, and then her family moved to Arizona for her father's health. At 19, she met a young airman who was stationed at a nearby airfield. The two began dating, though he often talked about his younger brother, telling Jennifer, "You'd be good together." In 1944, a friend offered her an opportunity to meet Gene Kelly, the actor, dancer, and entertainer. She traveled to California and liked it there enough to stay, finding a job at a Lockheed aircraft factory. The entire area, she recalled, was covered by a tarp, painted with houses, trees, and other fixtures of the suburbs, meant to conceal the factory from potential enemy surveillance or targeting. She shared a small apartment with friends, day shifters and night shifters, alternating in twin beds and getting rides from co-workers. "We all worked 7 days a week," she said. All the women had to wear a scarf over their hair for safety reasons, like the one worn in the iconic Rosie the Riveter image. They worked on the plane in sections, and to preserve secrecy, they never saw the planes in their entirety. McMullen later learned she'd worked on the Lockheed XP-58 Chain Lightning, a long-range fighter plane made to improve on the P-38 Lightning. After several months, she went back to work as a legal secretary and was able to rent a room at the home of that young airman, since he and his brother were both still away at war. When the war ended in 1945, she remembered being in Los Angeles amongst all the hugging and kissing that you see depicted in photos of that time, sharing in the joy and relief at the end of the long, brutal conflict. Mel McMullen, the younger brother she'd heard so much about, returned from Asia later that year, and within 6 weeks, he and Jennifer were engaged. Meanwhile, her friend and roommate hit it off well with the older brother, so both couples had a double wedding at Fort Douglas Air Force Base in Salt Lake City on May 13, 1946. Supplying the arsenal of victory. It's undeniable that, without women's contributions, the war would not have gone the Allies' way. More than 6 million American women took jobs in factories, and another 3 million volunteered with the Red Cross, while more than 200,000 women joined the military, primarily in auxiliary branches like the Women's Army Corps, WAC, Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service, WAVES, and Women Air Force Service Pilots, WASP. Guys noted, too, that because the U.S. entered the war later than European allied nations, and because of the geographic isolation of the U.S., Americans were in a better position to manufacture the guns, munitions, aircraft, and ships needed to fight. Much of Europe's manufacturing infrastructure had been depleted by years of warfare, and American factories across a wide spectrum of industries were operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was an all-out effort, she said, and those jobs were not always easy. Welders, burners, riveters, all worked within very confined spaces, like within the holds of ships. Some jobs were dangerous and required not only skill, but also physical strength. One woman I interviewed talked about carrying heavy equipment, like welding tanks. When the war ended, many women left the factories and turned their energy toward the home, raising families and settling into domestic life. McMullen and her husband had 3 sons, and she was a stay-at-home mother while they were growing up. After that, she worked as a secretary at an intermediate school and later at California State University's San Bernardino campus. She and Mel, who worked in title insurance and trust, were active in their community as well, participating in Masons, Rotary, and Women's Clubs. In retirement, the couple has traveled extensively, visiting more than 80 different countries. McMullen looks back on her time as a riveter with a mixture of pride, but also humility. The women jumped in and did all the things the men weren't there to do, she said. We enjoyed the work, but we missed the men in our lives. We did what we had to do. From Vanity Fair, how Jennifer Lopez is using romantic comedy to reclaim her narrative. The reason we root for J-Lo in movies is the reason we root for J-Lo in real life. A meta-narrative that's made her one of modern rom-com's most effective stars. By Savannah Walsh. While promoting her new romantic comedy, Office Romance, Jennifer Lopez has fielded questions about dating coworkers, past and present. You're single right now? Jimmy Kimmel asked her during an appearance on his late-night show last week. I am, Lopez confirmed, interrupting Kimmel's next query to add, I should have done it sooner. The studio audience audibly reacted to the admission, an apparent reference to her divorce from Ben Affleck, which was finalized in January 2025. Bennifer, the portmanteau used by tabloids during her relationship with Affleck, began on the set of Geely, the 2003 film that may have been the most cursed romantic comedy of all time. More than 20 years later, Lopez declared to Kimmel, I've been doing it all wrong, adding with a sly smile, I've been doing it all wrong, trust me. The exchange felt familiar, like dialogue borrowed from an early J-Lo rom-com, the first of which arrived 25 years ago. Later in the interview, Lopez insisted she's not looking for love right now. I'll meet somebody somewhere one day, she said wistfully. If they're good enough, I don't know. Exactly the sort of thing her stoically single characters would have said at the start of The Wedding Planner, or Made in Manhattan. She just hasn't met Matthew McConaughey's bespectacled pediatrician, Steve, who, oops, is already engaged to one of her clients when they meet cute. or Rafe Fiennes, playboy politician, who will mistake Lopez's hotel maid for an upper-class single mother staying as a guest. After Selena made Lopez a star, and the following years Out of Sight established her crackling chemistry with George Clooney from the trunk of a sedan, Lopez set her sights on rom-coms, signing on to The Wedding Planner and Made in Manhattan. I felt like all the women in romantic comedies always looked the same way. They were always white, Lopez told The Hollywood Reporter in 2019. And I was like, if I can do it and just show that I'm every girl, because I am the hopeless romantic, I am that, I am the single working woman, I was those things, I remember thinking, I need to be the lead in a romantic comedy. Both movies were commercial successes. The Wedding Planner grossed nearly $95 million worldwide on a budget of $35 million, opening at number one at the U.S. box office on Super Bowl weekend. Combined with the success of her second album, J-Lo, Lopez became the first woman to have a number one film and album at the same time in the country. Critics were less enthused, but early New York Times reviews lauded J-Lo in the working woman finds love genre. Her Made in Manhattan performance drew comparisons to Golden Age stars, including Claudette Colbert and Lauren Bacall. But Lopez's initial rom-com hot streak came to a very public halt 2 years later, when she and future husband Affleck fronted Gigli, a romantic crime caper that the Wall Street Journal called the worst allegedly major movie of our admittedly young century. In the shadow of Bennifer's real-life relationship drama, Gigli and the subsequent Jersey Girl, also co-starring Affleck, both flopped. Lopez and Affleck called off their 2003 wedding 3 days before walking down the aisle. When Gigli failed at the box office, I was eviscerated, Lopez said in an interview with Vanity Fair in 2017. I lost my sense of self, questioned if I belonged in this business, thought maybe I did suck at everything. Plus, Lopez added, my relationship self-destructed in front of the entire world. It was a 2-year thing for me until I picked myself up again. Lopez didn't abandon the genre entirely, but she never found an on-screen counterpart who truly matched her particular skill for romantic comedies. The Tom Hanks to her Meg Ryan, the Richard Gere to her Julia Roberts. She did, however, teach Gere's listless suburban husband to rekindle his passion with Susan Sarandon in Shall We Dance? The following year's Monster in Law focused on Lopez and her character's future mother-in-law, played by Jane Fonda, rather than Michael Vartan, who played her groom. Putting Jennifer Lopez in your romantic comedy automatically gets you halfway to a decent movie. The male lead hardly matters, the New York Times wrote in its review of the largely forgettable Shotgun Wedding. Josh Duhamel, Lopez's love interest is not exactly Clark Gable, but Lopez makes it work. She always does, the review adds. Much of the dialogue feels canned and phony in the style of a badly written sitcom, but coming out of J-Lo's mouth, I believed it. Around the mid-aughts, Lopez formed New Eurekan Productions Incorporated with longtime manager Benny Medina. Their first project was another rom-com, Second Act, in which Lopez plays an assistant manager at a Queens big box store, opposite real-life pal Leah Remini as her on-screen best friend. She followed it up with the ultra-meta rom-com Marry Me, starring Lopez as a pop star set to wed her famous fiancé, played by Colombian singer Maluma, in a splashy Madison Square Garden wedding. When she's left at the altar, Lopez's character plucks a math teacher out of the audience, played by Owen Wilson, and marries him instead. In real life, Lopez was engaged to former New York Yankee Alex Rodriguez. Speaking to Vanity Fair in 2020, before the film's release, Lopez admitted that publicly dating Mark Anthony and divorcing him in 2014 following the Bennifer bedlam had left scars. "You're out there on your own, making mistakes, and I made plenty over the years," she said. "I watched my personal life crash and burn many times, and then have to live with that. People don't understand how much it hurts to go through these things and to fail in front of the world." By the time Marry Me was released in 2022, J-Lo and Rodriguez had called it quits 2 years into their engagement. And just like her character, Lopez was already moving on. Nearly 20 years after first splitting, she and Affleck revived their love story in summer 2021, finally making it down the aisle of a Las Vegas chapel the next July. Lopez announced their wedding by invoking her idol, Barbara Streisand, referencing "Sadie, Sadie, Married Lady," a classic Funny Girl song. Perhaps inspired by Streisand, who directed herself in cinematic love stories Yentl, The Prince of Tides, and The Mirror Has Two Faces, Lopez then poured $20 million of her own money into telling her own. In 2024, Amazon released the film This Is Me Now, a love story, inspired by Lopez and Affleck's second chance romance, as explored on the album This Is Me Now, a riff off her 2002 album This Is Me Then. The visual album of sorts raised concerns in J-Lo's inner circle. "It feels too much like you're trying to prove something," former co-star Fonda told Lopez, "instead of just living it." In the behind-the-scenes documentary that accompanied the movie, The Greatest Love Story Never Told, Affleck noted, "I did really find the beauty and the poetry and the irony in the fact that it's the greatest love story never told. And if you're making a record about it, that seems kind of like telling it." But Lopez has always worn her heart on her sleeve. "It was so painful after we broke up," she told Apple Music's Zane Lowe in November 2022. Once we called off that wedding 20 years ago, it was the biggest heartbreak of my life. I honestly felt like I was going to die. Lopez said the decision sent me on a spiral for the next 18 years, where I just couldn't get it right. By now, 20 years later, it does have a happy ending. It has the most would-never-happen-in-Hollywood ending. As foretold by Geely, neither Bennifer, the love story, nor any art born from it was built to last. Lopez filed for divorce on the 2-year anniversary of their wedding ceremony, before it was finalized early last year. "Do you think you've truly been loved?" Howard Stern asked J-Lo during an October 2024 interview on his radio show. She paused and responded, "No," before switching to, "Yes," as she considered if she had really experienced loving someone. "What I learned is it's not that I'm not lovable," Lopez concluded. "It's that they're not capable." It was a vulnerable moment for J-Lo, the kind familiar to anyone who has loved and lost, and for the past 25 years, she has imbued her rom-com performances with similar feelings, as her characters have grappled with insecurity, infidelity, and being underestimated. Amid the split, Lopez boarded Office Romance, a movie that seems to understand that audiences root for J-Lo, the rom-com heroine, in part because we root for J-Lo off-screen, too. "We saw something in her that hadn't been written before," the film's leading man, Brett Goldstein, told the Associated Press. He and co-writer Joe Kelly created the role of Jackie Cruz, an airline CEO who falls for her recently hired lawyer, Daniel Blanchflower, played by Goldstein, to play to Lopez's strengths. In her previous rom-coms, she's always very low status and aspirational and trying to achieve something. But we wanted to make something a bit more grown up, where she's the CEO. She's achieved a lot. She's done great. But there is something sort of missing. When Lopez received the script, she felt like, "I know this," she said in the same interview with Goldstein. "You somehow got inside my head and my skin when you wrote this, and I'm going to offer as much as I can to it, because I actually know what this is. I understand who this person is." Indeed, hot off a Gen Z salute in the viral teen show Off Campus, Lopez gets another kind of tribute with Office Romance, complete with surprisingly steamy yet breezy chemistry between Lopez and Goldstein. It feels like a freer version of J-Lo, on screen and off, a Lopez who wields the highly exposed nature of her own love life to remind us that heartbreak is human. Because the woman who got back with her ex of 20 years, married him in a Vegas wedding, and spent $20 million of her own money to make movies nobody was sure should exist, is perhaps the only kind of person I trust with making a certain kind of romantic comedy. From the Boston Globe, for a good life, Write Your Obituary Now by Helene Rosenthal. I recently wrote my obituary, and it cleared up a lot of things. I actually don't want to climb Machu Picchu, or go back to school, or make amends with a friend I haven't spoken to in 11 years. I am also less bothered than I thought by my neighbors who throw their dog refuse in my garbage bin, or my nephew whose politics I find frustrating, or the way my husband hums when there's a gap in conversation. What matters to me is baking beautiful desserts for the homeless at a nearby shelter, writing about ideas that spark conversation, making new friendships, and not being a burden on my children as I age. I am 64 years old, and I am not dying. But if I get struck by lightning tomorrow, I'm all set. I got the idea to write my own obituary from a sports psychologist on TikTok, Karina Baldwin. She uses this activity to help clients crystallize what's important to them and the legacy they want to leave. I was sold immediately and started writing. I wish I had done it in my 20s. It would have saved me from years of self-doubt and wondering what I wanted to do with my life. I could have referred to my own obituary and known that job on Wall Street wasn't the right fit for me. But instead, I took the job, got fired, and then spent the next couple of months wondering why I was such a colossal failure. I grew up reading the obituaries with my mom. It was how we said good morning to each other. We often came across the obituaries of people in our mutual orbit, like my high school math teacher or the woman behind the deli counter. We almost always came across details that surprised us. My math teacher was a published poet. The woman who cut our deli meat raised bees and was a winner of the Black Jar Grand Prize for her honey. Turns out obituaries are having a moment. Local newspapers, once the only place to run a death notice, often charge per word, making them costly to publish for a lot of people. But now sites like Keeper Memorials, Epilogue, and Everloved allow you to create an online memorial for free. Gone are the generic lists of dates, survivors, and hometowns, and in their place is some great storytelling. Instagram and TikTok feeds like Tips from Dead People and Reddit boards share these mini memoirs with their massive followings. It's the corner of the internet where the dead come alive in hilarious and profound ways. Spending time thinking about the way I want to be remembered has made me much less skittish about talking about death. Sometimes I even joke about what I want my tombstone to say. She made a great banana cake and tried hard at everything else. You'll have to wait, hopefully for a very long time, to read my full obituary, but here's how it starts. I really hope I died with the trash taken out and the kitchen thoroughly cleaned up after having an entire thin crust pizza alongside an ice-cold IPA beer. In this life, I was lucky. I moved to New York City, where I fell in love with the best kind of human, one from Boston. Now that my obituary is written, I don't worry that my family is going to be so busy managing lasagnas that they will hand off the story of my life to a distant cousin who I haven't seen in 12 years. Truth be told, I always like having the last word, and even 6 feet under, I will. From Better Homes and Gardens, these sugared Prosecco grapes are the sparkling treat your summer needs, by Sophia Beams. Pop open a bottle of bubbly, but don't pour your glass just yet. First, you should use your Prosecco to make a delicious fruity treat to snack on all summer long. Prosecco grapes. This viral snack is crisp, sweet, and tart. Best of all, it only takes a few minutes of active time to make. How to make Prosecco grapes. All you need are green grapes and some Prosecco. You might also want granulated sugar for a topping. While you can use red grapes for this recipe, you'll want to choose the sweetest grapes possible to help offset the tartness of the Prosecco. 1. Start by thoroughly washing your grapes, then add them to a bowl and cover them with Prosecco. Leave them to marinate in the fridge overnight so that they'll soak up as much sparkling wine as possible. The next morning, they'll be full of tangy, sweet flavor. 3. Drain the Prosecco, ideally into a jug or bottle, if you want to save it for later use as a cocktail mixer. 4. Gently pat your grapes dry if they're still wet. 5. Add a thin layer of granulated sugar to a plate or serving tray. Then roll the grapes in it. Pop your Prosecco grapes in the freezer for an hour or two before serving them. Take them out when they're fully frozen for an irresistible snack, or leave them in the freezer for under an hour for a slushy treat. Serving. Once each grape has been thoroughly coated, they're ready to serve. Use your Prosecco grapes as a delightful cocktail garnish. Serve them in a bowl as a snack, or add them to a charcuterie platter. However you decide to serve the delicious treat is up to you, but be prepared for refills because they're sure to be savored. Easy swaps for your Prosecco grapes. No Prosecco? No problem. You can also use champagne as an alternative with a similar flavor. Vodka is another easy swap, though you should dilute it, for example, with a flavored soda to make a successful marinade. Feel free to add other flavors to your Prosecco or champagne, too. A splash of orange juice, a squeeze of citrus or soda will give extra depth and sweetness to this trendy snack. And that brings us to the end of the program. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. And please join me again for the Women's Hour.
Are you a senior who is dealing with vision loss? Would you like to learn about advocacy efforts on behalf of seniors who are blind? And about support calls, where you can talk with other seniors who are also dealing with vision loss? If so, join us, the Alliance on Aging and Vision Loss, an affiliate of the American Council of the Blind. To learn more, visit our website, www.aavl-blind-seniors.org.